there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. Okay, so today's conversation is a bit more meta, and this is a recording of a chat I had recently with a very serious and capable young man living here in Japan who's doing his preliminary research about the possibility of starting his own real estate brokerage or consultancy business here. And we talk about what it's like to work as a real estate professional in Japan, licensing, certifications, and niches that might be beneficial for a foreigner to work in specifically, and why we exist, what services we provide and how much they cost, how do realtor commissions work in Japan, and how much one can expect to earn as an agent. And then we take a bit more of a bird's eye view and we discuss Japan's property market prospects globally. What are the barriers to entry into a Japanese real estate property business? Is it necessary to have a Japanese partner? How much does it cost to set up? And also, how does the RAINS database work? Where to find listings? Why to use realtors and judicial scriveners in the first place? And that then led us to a discussion of post-settlement disputes and disagreements. And finally, a bit of sales and marketing. So how do we get our clients? How do we handle the competition? What are some various unserved niches, again, that a new player could potentially get into and so forth? So definitely good info in there for anyone thinking of pursuing a similar path, but also quite a few good nuggets for anyone interested in this market sector overall. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
So what is your experience like having been in the real estate business in Japan for about 10, 11 years now?
Yeah. What's my experience?
I
don't think that I can sum that up in a sentence. Maybe give me something a bit more specific.
Okay. So what are your thoughts on were Japanese getting into real estate business as opposed to foreigners getting into real estate business?
Real estate business as a rule, I think, is open to foreigners. If you're talking about becoming a licensed real estate agent or a licensed real estate professional, that can be very challenging to foreigners. It's one of the more difficult certification tests that you can take, even for Japanese. I think the pass rate is about 15-17%. So for a foreigner, with the amount of legalese and kanji and professional terms that are included in the study materials, it's a very, very challenging test. Otherwise, the foreigners who I know who are dealing in real estate in Japan, naturally, they find themselves best served by working in the niche that they occupy. So they serve foreigners in one way or another. They help them buy, they help them sell, they help them rent apartments. And it's a bustling, active, profitable market. I know quite a few foreigners who are active in it. Obviously a lot less than Japanese, but,
So the exam is called like Takken, right? And is the license also called
Takken? Takken. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So like, because from what I know, it's like, with one, real estate license, you're only allowed to have up to like five people in working in your company, right?
I'm not aware of that. We're not Takken, and we don't plan to be a real estate brokerage or agency, so I haven't really dug into that. I'm sorry.
Okay, okay. Could you tell me more about your business?
Yeah, we represent investors and buyers of holiday homes and buyers of land, buyers of, so who, whatever, foreigners who are interested in buying, selling, or managing properties in Japan. So we represent them here as their proxies. So they don't have to come here if they don't have to, or even if they live here, but they don't want to be involved in the meetings, and they want somebody to either hold their hand and guide them through the process, or to facilitate the entire process on their behalf. So we work with the real estate agencies, or with the property managers, with the building management companies. We're like an extension of the buyer.
Oh, interesting. So it's because I'm just making assumptions here, but is it because it might be difficult for foreigners to negotiate with Japanese only real estate companies, especially
well,
when they
the,
want
to? The Japanese professional companies in most locations around the country tend to be very foreigner shy, or at least they've never had the experience of working with foreigners. The vast majority of them can't speak, read, or write English. They can't, especially if the foreigner is residing overseas, they don't know how to receive and send funds overseas. They can't, they don't know how to handle online documentation or signings or anything of the sort that would actually enable foreigners to deal with them. And for that purpose, except for Central Tokyo, Central Osaka, Niseko up in Hokkaido, and a few other little spots around the country where for some one reason or another are more internationally renowned areas. So there you could potentially find some professionals who could work with you as a foreigner. In Tokyo, for example, I know two or three reliable ones, in Osaka maybe one. Fukuoka, I know they exist, but we haven't worked with them. I can't really recommend or not recommend them, but I think there's only two or three of them. So the rest of the country, it's just completely out of the question. And you have to work with a local Japanese company. And to do that, if you're not here or you're not fluent in the language, and sometimes even if you are, just because you're a foreign face or your name is foreign or you've got an accent, it's quite challenging. So for that reason, so that's half of the reason for our existence. And the other half is just the fact that the market here is a bit unique in many aspects. There are things here that don't exactly work the way that they work in other property markets around the world. So it's quite handy, even if you can logistically function in the market, it's quite handy to have somebody who's on your side, because real estate agents, by nature of their position, I mean, they could be appointed by the buyer, they could be appointed by the seller, but they're really transactional. Their job and their purpose and their goal is to finalize transactions. Often they need to finalize as many transactions as they can to meet their quotas. They're not, even if they're representing the buyer or the seller, they're not going to necessarily tell them what to watch out for, what questions to ask. They're not going to flow. They're going to be very honest and professional, because it's Japan. I mean, they don't swindle you or run off with your money or what, but they're not going to go out of their way to make sure you're getting the best deal that you can get. You know, if you're interested in the property and they think you might buy it, they'll just say, yeah, let's buy it. You know, so it helps to have somebody professional on your side who has only your interest in mind. So we don't have a particular pool of properties that we're interested in selling. We don't get extra commissions if we sell the properties that we list ourselves. We're strictly on the buyer side or on the customer side. And we don't mind which agency we work with, which city we purchase in. We just try to give them the best professional advice and to tell them the right questions to ask and the answers that they should be expecting to receive. So that's the other half of our, the other reason for our existence is this professional advisory that we give to customers.
So like, what is the range of commissions that you can maybe make or make and sort of income from, especially in your industry?
The real estate brokerage commission is defined by law. It's 3% plus 60,000 yen plus tax. Mm-hmm. We charge a similar amount as an added payment. So our fee is separate to the realtors. But if the property is very, very cheap, for example, you know, out in the Japanese countryside, you can buy properties for $5,000, $10,000, for example. So we do have a minimum limit that we will charge. So regardless of how cheap the property is, the minimum that you'll need to pay us to facilitate the purchase is 5% of 5 million yen, so about 250,000 Japanese yen.
250,000 for to facilitate the service, right?
5% of 5 million yen to conduct full purchase facilitation. So we'll research, we'll conduct due diligence, we'll contact agents and sellers, and we'll keep on doing that until we find the property that we're all satisfied to move ahead with. And we'll take it all the way to settlement and appoint a property manager if it's an investment property. And all of that is done under a fixed price that depends on the price of the property. So it's 3 or 4 or 5% of the property price, depending on the price of the property.
What do you think? What are your thoughts on the scope of the market? Like, how much can you expand with this sort of business? And what is the future looking like for this business?
Well, it depends. The world's second biggest property market. It's transactions, and I think capital-wise, it's second only to the USA. Mm-hmm. And it's also the only country in Asia where land is freehold for non-resident buyers, or at least there's no limitations of any sort on non-resident buyers. Like Australia is also freehold, for example, but foreigners can only buy brand new off-the-plan development properties, right? They cannot buy a secondhand property that's got a tenant in it already, for example. So Japan is the only country in Asia Pacific that doesn't have any limitations on foreign buyers. So considering the size of the market and the transparency and the liquidity of the market, I see it as, I'd say, unless the population really shrinks beyond a certain point, I'd say it's an endless scope. I mean, definitely for a small company like ours, there's a lot of room to expand. Yeah.
So I really want to learn more about this particular industry and like what are the scope, especially let's say you're, when you're starting up, what is the capital requirement for you to start up such a business? And what is the entry barriers to entry for people who are already living in Japan, but are maybe foreigners?
Well, financially, it doesn't cost that much to set up a business. So assuming that you're going to bootstrap it and, you know, the first few years or the first few months, at least work from home and, you know, minimize your expenses, then all you need to pay is usually about 150 or 200,000 yen to set up the company. And then annually for accounting and bookkeeping, the minimum corporate tax, depending on which city you set up, but the minimum corporate tax that you'll have to pay, even if you haven't made any profits, is going to be about 100,000 yen. And then your accounting and bookkeeping for a commercial entity like a company would cost you every year, depending on the accountant and how fluent in English they are, but let's say about 150, 200,000 yen at a minimum, right? So the financial barrier to entry, aside from the setup cost, is can you afford to pay $3,000-$4,000 a year in corporate maintenance, even if you're not making any money, right?
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
If you want to like have the business license for or like business manager visa for SSA, you need to have like an address for your business, right?
I thought you said you're living in Japan.
I am living in Japan, but like you cannot declare your address or your residency as your business address, no?
Well, that's if you need a visa. If you've already got a visa and you're already living in Japan, then nobody cares where your office is. It can be your home.
See, is there a need for, like, let's say, a Japanese partner for legal reasons? Like
legally, no. But that's to answer the other part of your question about the barriers to entry, you're probably going to find that because if you're working in Japan's real estate market, even if your customers are all foreigners, the third parties that you're going to be dealing with on a regular basis are, of course, Japanese companies, Japanese sellers, Japanese organizations. And you'll probably find that a lot of them will be quite reluctant to work with a foreigner, even if you're very fluent in Japanese. So I would very much advise to have a Japanese partner who can handle at least the initial contact with any new company or new person that you want to be working with, right? So in our case, for example, once we've had a meeting with a particular realtor and we've done a deal or two with them, then I can call them up and say, hey, I got a customer coming. Can you meet us and take us to see some properties and stuff like that? So they know me. They already know that, you know, my Japanese is not very proper. It's very casual. And, you know, I don't dress or act or behave in exactly the way that they would expect me to. And it's fine because they already know who we are. But if I was to try and make the initial contact in the initial meeting and show up the way I am as a foreigner in a meeting for the first time with and the real estate industry is quite old school in Japan as well. It's not exactly cutting edge technology and, you know, international minded and so forth. So at least for the first contact with the Japanese entity, it's always good if that's conducted by a native Japanese person who can speak proper Keigo and everything. So I would definitely advise to get a Japanese partner. Yeah.
So suppose you're starting like do you know much about realtor business?
Realtor?
Yeah.
Hmm? Yeah, we work with them on a daily basis. Well, what's the question?
So suppose you're starting up like a realtor business as opposed to the real estate brokerage business. How do you access the property markets? Like say you don't, you yourself, you're going to hire a realtor with a tuck-in the license. You can have like up to 5 real estate agents. So say you don't want to work with any real estate companies anymore and you want to do it directly by yourself. In this scenario, like how would you access the property markets without the realtors?
Well, you don't have, without the tuck-in license, you don't have access to the RAINS database. The internal Japanese, I'm not sure if it's a government database or a real estate association database, but anyway, it's the main online database that all agents access. Mm-hmm. But almost all of the properties that you'll find in there, you're going to find on MLS websites as well. So it's not crucial. For example, when we do our research, we don't even access RAINS. We just go and look online, or we contact agents that we've worked with in the past and ask them for deals in that particular criteria and so forth. And then they might go and search RAINS for us, but it's not a limitation for us to be able to work now.
So as far as I know, let's say you don't want to bring the person with tuck-in license, but you just want to get the realtors. In this scenario, like if you want to, let's say, borrow this person's license to operate the business, I think that costs you easily like 250, 30, sanju mangurai.
Well, you're not going to be conducting real estate transactions by yourself without a license. You're not allowed to.
Okay.
So you would have to work with a tuck-in, but If you contact the listing, let's say you found a property and you have a customer who's interested in that property is anyway going to be listed by a Japanese realtor, right? Those are the people who make those listings appear online, right? So they get paid by the seller in any case, and the buyer side needs to pay them a commission in any case as well. So you can't collect that commission unless you're a licensed realtor and can do the transaction yourself in any case. So I'm not sure what you mean by borrowing them or using them exactly.
Because I've seen a lot of real estate companies and like because the tuck-in rule, right? If you have like one person with a license, you can hire up to 5 real estate agents and all of them can have actually profit off the commissions. This is because I have a few friends who've done the same. And the reason I bring that up is because there are some companies who, instead of having to hire another person, because they already have one person with that license, they don't want to hire one more person to hire another 5 agents. So what they essentially do is they rent out this person's license and they pay them like a monthly fee, like us and Niju Sanjuman licensing the rent.
So that they're able to hire 5 more people.
Pretty much. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's so is that what you're planning to do? You're planning to become a licensed brokerage?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of doing. Yeah.
Okay, I understand. So, those are considerations that I don't have, and I'm not aware of them because we don't have to comply with those kind of licenses.
Mm-hmm. Well, so for in your business, for example, how do you say you want to make off? Is most of your income just primarily from the service itself, or are you able to also get a share of the commission when you sell the real estate property to the buyer?
So we get paid by the buyers for the service separately to all the other real estate costs involved. So the realtor gets their commission, the legal and the registration fees get paid. Taxes, of course, get paid, but we get paid separately. So our customers hire us in advance. They pay our fee or a fee estimate, depending on what budget they think they'll be purchasing in advance. And from that point, we start representing them. That's the main source of our income. The other... it used to be a minor source, but now as we have a larger and larger client portfolio, it's becoming more of a major source, is the monthly management of the portfolio. And then agents or judicial scriveners that we've worked with on a regular basis for a long time also pay us a small commission of their fee, but that's very minor. It's like 10% of what they make, they give to us for giving them a client a deal.
That's very interesting. So in your form of business, like how exactly do you define it as a real estate brokerage business, right?
Sorry?
How exactly do you define your business?
We are portfolio managers and proxies, or buyer's advocates is another term you can use.
Okay.
Buyer's advocates is maybe not entirely correct because we help people sell and manage the property as well. Mm-hmm. Probably more accurate to call us proxies or portfolio managers.
Okay, portfolio management. I see. What is a capital requirement for that type of business? Especially like if you're not working in Tokyo, let's say you're working in a different area like Osaka, somewhere like in near the Kansai region.
The cost of capital would be entirely up to you, depending on how you're going to be running your business. If you want to have a street shop front where people can just walk in, then obviously it's going to cost you a certain amount of rent per month. Mm-hmm. If you want to immediately hire staffers to handle the paperwork or the phone, then it's going to, that question is something that you can define for yourself. Depending on what your capital is, to start a business online from home, which is how we started, doesn't cost much.
See.
And then as you can see that you're generating income, you can then decide if you're going to expand, if you want to afford the monthly rent, the monthly staffers, whatever you need.
All right. So I wanted to ask another question on like the RAINS database. Do you by any chance have any licensed professionals working for you?
No. We work with third parties again, so they would be the ones logging in or looking at the RAINS.
Okay. Because I was looking into the database and read somewhere that you actually have to pay money to list on RAINS.
I think so, but that's only if you want other agents to help sell your properties. In your case, you're probably going to be marketing them directly to foreigners.
Right.
So there's not really any advantage in Japanese agent helping you find buyers for Japanese properties that doesn't serve your niche, does it?
No, the reason why I bring it up is because, say, I find someone who has a property in Japan and he wants to sell his property, or he or she wants to sell his property. Do they have to list it on Rains, or can they sell it outside of Rains?
As far as I'm aware, they can sell it outside of Rains as well, as long as there's a realtor involved in the transaction. I mean, you could legally, you can actually sell a property directly from one owner to another without a realtor. We do this, for example, when our client wants to sell a property and we have another client who wants to buy it. And you could even sell a property without a judicial scrivener. You could actually go to the Legal Affairs Bureau and conduct the ownership transfer yourself together with the seller. But that's highly unrecommended if you want to avoid future complaints and disputes and whatnot.
Why?
Well, the judicial scrivener is the equivalent of a property lawyer, and they're the ones who make sure that the title deed is kosher, that everything is documented properly, that all the documents and the money have changed hands properly, and they're government licensed, and their authority on the transaction prevents any potential legal disputes in the future.
Yes, so has there been an incident in your case where there has been a legal issue after you've changed hands?
Not legal, no. We've had a dispute or complaint from our end. We, on one occasion, we found out that the realtor, I don't know if it was through a fault of their own or just the seller misled them, I'm not sure, but they've misrepresented the information, some of the information related to the property, which we only found out after the purchase. We relayed the information to them. We, you know, submitted an official complaint to the company, and they ended up reversing the transaction, refunding all of the costs plus compensation. They're very concerned about their license not being renewed if there are too many complaints against them. So Japan as a rule is not really a litigation kind of environment. People here try to avoid legal action as much as they can.
Yeah, because of the 99%.
That's criminal law. No, that's nothing to do with that.
Okay.
That's criminal law. No, they don't like conflict, and obviously court is like the epitome of conflict, so they just prefer to avoid it.
But like in a scenario where the information has been misinformed, or it could be a criminal offense.
It could be, but I think more significantly for the realtor, they could lose their license, right? Yeah, that's what they're most concerned about.
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area, so Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's ARK Reform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
So like in your case, when you started 10, 11 years ago, right, your business in Japan, how did you come about finding the clients for your business?
Our marketing was always content-based inbound marketing. So we write a lot of articles. We have the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Recently, in the last couple of years, we started also doing videos. So some of the podcasts we convert to video format. I'm recording calls like this that I do with people like you or with customers or potential customers. And we publish all of that content on our own channels and occasionally as a guest content on another platform, like, for example, Singapore financial investment magazine who was interested, or an Asian real estate magazine who was interested in publishing articles about Japan. We just make sure that our content is spread as far as wide and as far and as wide as possible. We're active in groups and forums. We answer questions. We run our own groups and forums where people are actively asking questions, receiving answers. And by being seen in the places where people who might be interested tend to populate, they eventually, when they do want to take action and purchase a property, then we just automatically come to mind as, oh yeah, that person's been posting about real estate for a few years now. They must know what they're doing, and then they contact us.
Like, how would you say, compare to a competitor who right now there are like a lot of young companies that are starting up videos on TikTok, say YouTube. So how would you how do you compete with them? How would you prevent yourself from losing clients or from gaining future customers?
Losing clients, or losing clients to competition, was never a huge concern for me. I tend to, this is maybe going back to our offline conversation about philosophies and values, but I tend to feel that the world is abundant enough for as many businesses as I don't think there's a limit on the number of customers that a business might be able to get. So when somebody gets a customer, I don't feel that's coming out of my own pocket. And I tend to feel that the type of the content that we put out is different to the type of content that other people put out. And we tend to attract the right kind of customer. I mean, obviously it's never 100%. Once in a blue moon, we do get a customer that we end up not wanting to work with. But generally speaking, we'll be attracting the kind of customers who are attracted to the kind of content or the kind of image that we project, whereas people who do a different kind of marketing, I don't see that's a problem. If someone's attracted to, I mean, we also do videos, right? We're definitely, our marketing manager is now studying TikTok, and we occasionally put some stuff out on Instagram, and I don't feel that somebody who's attracted to a video that's, for example, showcasing quick money and high profits and flashy condos and overlooking the Tokyo Gawa River or stuff. I mean, that's not the kind of customers that we tend to attract, and we're not interested in them anyway. The customers who tend to find us tend to do business with us because they appreciate the leveled, neutral information that we present, the fact that we also point out the negatives and not just the positives, and we break down due diligence into very, very clear numbers, and we evaluate everything, and we point out. I mean, that's the stuff that attracts the kind of customers that we want to have to us, and that's fine with us. We're not trying to compete with people who are pumping out more flashy or I don't know, lucrative looking content or whatnot.
If someone were to start so portfolio right now, like in this year, or maybe say next year, 2023, like what sort of company would you, or what sort of business or niche area would you recommend them to focus on, especially in this market?
You mean what niche that's maybe not being served at the moment, that kind of thing? Let's see. So there are a few companies, I think one of them is still active, who were, for example, focusing on foreclosure properties. They do exist in Japan. It's a bit of a different system to the court foreclosures that you might be used to from other countries, but they do exist in Japan as well. That's a niche that I don't think is very properly being served at the moment. We do occasionally get questions about it, and we don't deal with it because it's too much of a hassle for us to constantly try to bid on auctions and attend court to get new information. So we're not active in that space, but I think people are asking about it more or less regularly.
Why isn't there enough attention on people doing that business? I mean, besides the difficulty of dealing with legal issues.
It's not the legal issues, it's just a very hands-on business. The auction system in Japan is closed auction. So everybody submits an offer on a sealed envelope, and then whoever submitted the top offer gets the property. And you're not going to have a chance to overbid somebody who bid higher than you and so forth. So what that means is that you're often submitting 100 offers to get the one property that you actually succeeded with, right? You also don't know what the other people are offering, so it's very difficult to exactly assess what's the right number to offer. And you're also buying sight unseen. There's very little information available on the property before you purchase it. So all of those combined for us create more of a hassle than we're happy to deal with, right? Another niche area that's currently not being served is holiday property management in the countryside. So if you've got properties that you want to lease out, let's say you've got a ski home somewhere up in Nagano, you're only using it for 2 weeks a year, and you want to lease it out, short-term stay, Airbnb, whatever, the rest of the year. There are simply no management companies in those areas, Japanese or English-speaking companies, that can help you with that, right? So usually because it's not worth it for them, if there's only two or three houses in an area that they might get as customers, it's not worth it for them, obviously, to set up shop. But if you were able to come up with a solution that would enable you to somehow outsource local people in that area to do the management tasks on the customer's behalf, if you were to become an expert in, for example, recruiting local cleaners and people who can handle check-ins and check-outs in areas that don't have this kind of service available for investors, for holiday homeowners, that's probably a niche that's going to be quite profitable, because we have constantly people asking about that, and we constantly have to tell them that we just can't help them because there's nobody there to manage the property for them, right?
I see. But then again, those the ones that actually have demand are fairly limited now.
How do you mean?
The areas that actually have demand, the residential, the holiday properties that actually have demand, are limited to a certain area, specific areas, right?
So yes. So the challenge is in having, because each local municipality have their own regulations about how attendant you have to be. For example, if you have to have a person within 30 minutes from the property, or 1 hour from the property, or just on call on the phone. So the challenge there would be to try and logistically position yourself in a place where you could have reasonable access to all of those locations that you would be serving and be able to get people. I mean, there's problems that you need to solve, but it's a niche that's not being served at the moment.
Interesting. Okay. Is there like any recommendation for you for, let's say, someone starting up shop like today? How would you address issues of profitability or not having enough clients? Let's say a lot of clients were probably not unwilling to work with you, especially when you're early and when you're new, right? As opposed to, let's say a client has four options and he says three of them are pretty experienced and one of them is extremely experienced, he's most unlikely to pick the one that is newest to the industry or newest in the market, the newest shop. So how would you, as a new shop or a new business in town, how do you address that?
Well, one option is what we just spoke about, is to own a niche that is not being served by others at the moment. Mm-hmm. So then there's no competition, really. That's how we started, for example. And now there are new companies who do similar things, but we've definitely got the run on them. We've been doing this for a long time and very efficiently. And the other way to differentiate yourself is obviously by the level of service that you provide. So, for example, if you serve your first customer free of charge or at a very low price, then you'll probably win over the competition, and then you'll have a case study, right? Then you'll have somebody to refer potential customers to in the future. And if you do a good job, then they'll testify that you did a good job, and then it becomes easier. The first customer is the hardest. After that, it becomes, it snowballs. It might take some time to snowball, but it will eventually get there. As long as you're doing a good job, obviously. If the product or service that you're offering is shit, then you're not going to have customers.
True. Yeah, so that's all I wanted to clarify for today.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but I will need to go soon. I've got another appointment that I have to go. But I'm happy to continue this on another day if you want. Or do you want to maybe do some homework and come back with more questions, and then we'll do another session?
That sounds good. That sounds good. All right.
Anytime. Always happy to go.
All right.
Yeah. Great meeting you, man.
Fantastic meeting you too. Have a good day. Bye.
So there you have it. Nice little peek behind the curtain of how the real estate industry in Japan works overall, with a bit of a gaijin foreigner twist for you. Hope you found some value in it. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.